Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, according to the UN, 70% of fisheries are overfished. In many parts of the world, there simply aren't enough fish to catch and make a profit. Given that there are billions of people who depend on fishing, either as food or as a source of income, something has to change, both for the industry and for the wider health of our oceans. The idea of sustainable fishing is nothing new, but the question is, which methods used by the fishing industry are actually sustainable? And how realistic is it to think that we'll get a vast global industry to actually adopt them? Well, with me to discuss this and more are Dr. Antonio Leroy, Head of Ocean Policy at the independent conservation organisation WWF at the European Policy Office. Hello there, Dr. Antonio.
Good morning, everyone.
And we also have Sophie Benbow, Head of Marine at Fauna and Flora International, the world's oldest international wildlife conservation organisation. Hello there, Sophie.
Hello. Pleasure to be here.
Ah, it's brilliant to have you both. Well, let's start off by getting a bit of an overview at the problem overall. 72% of the world is ocean. Antonia, how well do we know the state of the seas and the stocks of fish that are down there?
Well, we know a lot about the stocks that are already assessed, but mostly it's a commercial one. We don't know everything about the fish population, and we know that there is interaction between fish population. So you can target a stock, but you could also catch by catch, which may be not assessed, for instance. And today we know that one third of the world assessed stock are considered unsustainable, which is almost an equivalent to one out of three fish in your plate.
We've been talking about this for a long time, haven't we? We've known that it's a problem. But Sophie, if we carry on as we are, how long do we have before there's no fish left?
In all honesty, I'm not sure anyone knows the answer to that question. But what the science does show, and I think what Antonio has picked up on, is that we simply cannot carry on as we are. If we do carry on as we are on a trajectory to no fish, to very unhappy people and a kind of starving population, given the incredible importance of seafood protein to us globally. There is already an overfishing crisis and we need to change this. A report that came out recently, the State of the World Fisheries and Agriculture, which is published by the FAO, which indicates that global fisheries and aquaculture production is at a record high, that consumption has increased significantly in recent years and is continuing to rise. But alongside that, overall fisheries resources are continuing to decline due to a number of issues that I think most people are familiar with. So overfishing, pollution, poor management of stocks, and a number of other factors, not least climate change, and how that is also impacting on the fish stocks. I think as the fishing industry continues, we need to be aware of the kind of overall ecosystem impacts of reducing those fish stocks and how that will impact on the fish populations in the ocean. We are seeing some good progress, and the SOFIA report does illustrate that, but so much more is needed if we're going to turn the tide on unsustainable fishing. And if we fail to transform, there will be significant and widespread negative impacts on the fishing industry, the fishing sector, and the planet. So really, we need to change, and we need to find a way to incentivize the fishing industry to make those changes.
Okay, so Antonia, humans love fish. Fish consumption does vary quite a bit across the world. The question is really, have we gone too far and can the oceans recover? Is it a question of the number of fish? Is it the type of fish being caught? Or is it the method of fishing that's used where the greatest problems lie?
Yeah, indeed, humans love fish. And I think it's also key as a source of food, livelihood, but it's also contributing to food security and it's providing jobs. Humanities have consumed and relied on aquatic food more than ever before. So as mentioned with this FR report, the world was consuming around maybe 25 million tons of fish before in the early 60s. But now our global consumption has increased to about 160 million tons. So, and in parallel, overfishing has increased. This is the main problem. And it's where we see our marine resources declining. So we really went far, but I think it's not too late to react. We have seen marine ecosystems incredibly resilient and they can recover. We have good practice if they are given a chance. So for instance, it's scientifically demonstrated that marine protected area network can improve the quantity, the diversity, and in some cases, the value of the fish caught outside the protected area, because fish become bigger and because they have more time to grow, etc. So I think the problem is a bit holistic. It's not only the method, it can be. We, of course, need more selective method, but it's also the governments behind it. So we have seen cases when fishermen are coming together and doing like co-management to really manage the resource really well. So it depends on the season, the area they fish, but also the gear they use. And indeed, here there could be a lot of improvement.
So, Sophie, we have known about these problems for a long time, although, as Antonio says, new information is arising all the time. Why, seeing as we have known this problem, have we not seen meaningful change?
I think for me, it's economics. Fishing is big business globally for billions of people from the small-scale fishing side, which is incredibly important and cannot be underestimated. Mm. But also it's huge corporates, it's big conglomerates that are doing a lot of or underpinning a lot of the more industrial fishing effort. Seafood is currently the most globally traded animal protein. So it's just hugely important from an economic point of view to governments and to corporations. Mm. And I think from FFI side, what we would be calling for and looking for is a recognition that fish themselves are biodiversity. Fish are not just a commodity to be traded and from which a profit can be made. They are a fundamental part of the global ocean system. And we need to be viewing them like that and making the right decisions when it comes to fisheries management and quota allocations and all the other tools that do exist to better manage the fisheries so that we are considering the long-term conservation into the future.
But if it's so important, Sophie, to so many economies, why have we not seen meaningful change? Is it short-termism? Is it because it's tied to politics and the short-term nature of changes in government?
All of the above, I would say. I think it's incredibly politicized. I think there are big issues where you have, for example, the EU distant water fleets entering particularly waters around Africa, East Africa and West Africa. And that income is incredibly valuable to those more developing economies in Africa and other places around the world. And those countries can't afford to not give fishing licenses. So, fundamentally, I think it does come down to the money. And you're right, the kind of short-term views of politicians that want to make the most of resources while they're in power, both personally and for their nation.
Yeah. Okay. So, Antonio, if you can be really specific here for me, what are the most damaging fishing methods that are used and how do you define destructive fishing?
I think it really depends on the species targeted, the habitat, the impact on the habitat and the bycatch. So it's three dimensions. So it's hard to say there is one fishing method that is really bad. Some, of course, have more impact on the ecosystem. Like we have been speaking about bottom trawling. We really want to phase out bottom trawling because it's also having a lot of bycatch, but it's also harming the seabed habitats, which, have a key role in climate change as well, because it sequesters carbons and other things. But some other method, if used, on some, sand area or rocky area, really depending on the seabed and the habitat, can also be less harmful depending on what you use. Also, I think it's key to speak about mitigation measure. So mitigation measure, it's like tools that you can put in your nets, for instance, which help to release the bycatch, the turtles, for instance, the dolphin, etc. So we have good example, what we call TED, turtle excluding devices. So that release like 98% of the turtle catch in shrimp fisheries. So when you eat shrimp, if you don't have a turtle excluding device in your net, you have to know that you're also eating kind of turtle or you're contributing to turtle species extinction if there is not this mitigation device on board. So there is various ways to overcome the challenge, but clearly fishers need to be more selective and use a mitigation measure and really sort of the season, the habitat where they are fishing.
the definition of destructive is something that FFI has been trying to better understand, and going up to the kind of United Nations SDG framing, the Sustainable Development Goals, a specific reference to unsustainable IUU, illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing, and then also destructive fishing practices. And we felt that the definition of destructive of those three is the most poorly defined, and people are using it in very different ways in very different spaces. So we're running at the moment a collaborative research project with the University of Cambridge, BirdLife International and UNEP WCMC to try and reach consensus on what people mean by destructive fishing. It's a survey-led process following an academic method which has gone out widely across the globe. Essentially, we've had 80 respondents from 36 countries feeding into what a definition of destructive should be. There's huge consensus on the need for a better definition, and we're looking to try and progress towards consensus so that we can better and more meaningfully implement some of the global goals that reference that. And looking, the next step really in that process is looking at how we can reach consensus on the most contentious issues. The agreement areas are the things that Antonia's just mentioned. So bycatch, overfishing of targeted stocks, and then direct habitat damage. But there's other issues around particularly the socioeconomic impacts. So whether there's human rights issues at play, whether the small-scale fisher conflict is going on, those kind of more socioeconomic issues, there's a lot more disagreement on whether they should always be considered destructive fishing or whether they're more of a kind of secondary impact of some of the methods. So we're looking to develop some kind of risk assessment tool to engage with the fishing industry, seafood industry, so they can review their supply chain and understand how much of the product they're sourcing is coming from destructively fished methods.
Yeah, okay. I've got a very UK-centric question, really, for you, Sophie. So, Antonia, you can twiddle your thumbs for a second while we have a quick chat about this. Now, Sophie, is there a disconnect in the fact that here in the UK, we've got a rubbish diet, we eat a relatively low amount of fish? I mean, statistically, across Europe, we're really low. We're under 20 kilos a year, whereas nutritionists invariably recommend that we should be eating more oily fish. Does this confuse the message for you, for somebody who is working in Britain? Do you put it out there and people go, well, yeah, but I'm being told to eat more fish. I don't understand. Do you think there are confusing messages for the public here in the UK?
I don't think so. The most obvious messaging that is public facing is certification. So things like the Marine Stewardship Council, Blue Tick, which is fairly well recognised, I would say, by some sectors of the consumer market. But I think there's issues around the lower price products, fish fingers and all those kind of, you know, the mass produced non-fish looking products. And I think the British market, as I understand it, is a little bit squeamish. So, you know, whereas if you're in the Mediterranean, you'd happily sit down and eat a whole fish. I think in England, we're so wedded to our fish fingers and our processed fish and seafood products that is a bit of a barrier in terms of diversifying the fish that people are eating, which I think is another key thing. So I don't know the statistics off the top of my head. I don't know if you have them, but I'm sure in the UK, we probably eat 4 or 5 seafood products, salmon, tuna, cod, as the key things that are coming onto our plate. But really, if we were to diversify what we're willing to eat, then that would be much better for the ocean and arguably much better for ourselves as well.
Yeah, so eat more pollock, mackerel and megrim and things like that, and then things might be a bit better. So we have 20 kilos of fish that we eat every year, but the balance of that is not right. And I don't have those statistics to hand, but what I have got is statistics for the rest of Europe. So, Antonia, you are French, you are currently in Italy. In France, you eat 75% more fish by weight per capita than we do in the UK. In Italy, they eat 50%. Over in the Philippines, which has 273 million people, they eat 44 kilos of fish per year. Is it possible to dole out the level of responsibility to the countries that make the most impact, or does that not quite work?
Yes, I think we definitely need to raise awareness, maybe for developed countries to decrease the consumption a bit. eating more sustainably, meaning, as Sophie was saying, diversify what we eat, because we also focus on maybe 5-6 species. And as in EU, we have alternative proteins like vitamin and fatty acid, which can be easily found. So we need to be a bit careful. But I think consumers can have a role to play.
But my point really is there are certain countries that have a greater impact than others. And should the responsibility for solving the problem be shared out between those countries that make the greatest impact?
Yeah, of course. I think the country who have the greatest impact should ensure that there is transparency and traceability when they import products because they don't produce it. So to have a kind of a level playing field, you know, you cannot ask your producer to produce sustainably, to have a lot of requirements and importing where you don't know where it's come from. Maybe from, you know, boats who have slaves on board, which is happening a lot in illegal fishing fisheries. So yes, definitely, more we consume seafood, more we have responsibility on what end up in our plates.
Okay, so the concept of countries or well, it's the people within the countries. It's not a country itself that's doing it. But if people aren't playing by the rules that are set, it's very difficult to quantify that, isn't it? Sophie, is there any concept of any good estimates about the people who aren't applying themselves to restrictions on catches around the world, and I guess especially in where we know in here in Europe?
I'm not entirely sure. I think in terms of the traceability kind of piece, there is a piece of legislation, I guess we would call it the Port State Measures Agreement, which has not been ratified by all countries, but a lot of kind of pure fisheries scientists, fisheries managers would say that if all countries ratified and then implemented the Port State Measures Agreement, then that would go a long way to solving the kind of IUU illegal fishing piece. It would ensure more traceability and transparency along supply chains. So I think that's a really important thing that we could be addressing at the global scale.
But these conversations are being had at the highest level already, aren't they? How else can we affect change if change isn't really happening at a fast enough speed? So, Antonia, is it the consumers? Can consumers force the industry to change?
Yes, but I think the responsibility is on everyone. First, the policymaker. Indeed, they have to adopt regulation. I mean, in the EU, there is a clear regulation on illegal fishing, where, you know, they engage in dialogue with partners, with other main market sets like the US and Japan, who have also improved their legislation by cooperating. I think the industry has a responsibility, the retailers, they need to ask also transparency and traceability when they buy products. And consumers, of course, to put the pressure on retailers and to be careful on what they're eating. But I think you cannot ask the consumer to know everything about everything, every species, where it comes from, how it has been caught. So the retailers have also a key role to play here. But what consumers can do is clearly ask where the fish come from, do you know? And we have a bit played this game in the team, asking, oh, where is this fish come from when we went to restaurants or other places? And often the answers are pretty strange, funny, let's say, like from the ocean, well, a country where there is no fisheries, or with experts, but still, you know. And so at least we ask the question, so maybe they feel the pressure that they need to be transparent on what they're serving us.
Yeah. Are there countries that are leading the way on policy and actually putting policy into effect, Sophie?
There are. I don't think anybody is such an outright leader in the field that they are doing everything. There were a couple of announcements recently, actually. There was the United Nations Ocean Conference happened in Lisbon a few weeks ago. And Thailand made a commitment to not issue any new licenses to bottom trawlers, which was a fantastic announcement, and also have put aside quite a significant sum of money towards decommissioning the existing fleet. But like any of these things, that announcement needs to be followed by action and implementation. So we need to ensure that they follow through on those commitments. And I think that's the role for NGOs and local organisations in countries to support governments in following through on those commitments. Other countries such as Belize has also banned bottom trawling in particular. And a key topic that's coming up quite a lot around the world is this idea of inshore exclusion zones. So an area around a country within which more industrial large-scale fishing is excluded, prioritising access for small-scale fishers in those nearshore waters. And often those small-scale fishers are using less damaging methods, and small-scale fishers are often seen as the custodians of biodiversity. So they are the ones that are wholly reliant on the ocean for their livelihood, for their way of life. So it's definitely in their interest to ensure that they're fishing by sustainable means and through responsible approaches to the ocean.
Is small-scale sustainable fishing profitable enough to not just to carry on a daily basis, but to continue as an industry from one generation to the next?
Yeah, I think it depends on the country, but it is profitable. People are making money from it. It is an industry that's not going away. The recent SOFIA reports showed that 40% of the total global fish catch comes from small-scale fishers. So they are a not insignificant component of the global fish catch. And I think something that FFI is trying to do everywhere that we work is to support and empower those small-scale fishers to have a stronger voice, to engage directly with regional or national decision-making bodies, to engage in fisheries management processes. Often they're the ones with the data, the knowledge in their heads, but it's because it's not captured, because it's not necessarily well documented, then that information is not inputted into fisheries decision-making processes. So I think there's a real role for somebody like FFI and other NGOs to support that process. There's also some work that we have underway, which is, again, engaging with the small-scale fishers to help them improve, to reduce post-harvest losses, to support more cold storage along the supply chain, so to enable them to produce a better quality of product, which will then attract a higher price, and also some work to essentially cut out the middleman, so to link the buyers directly to the small-scale fishers so that they are able to negotiate and secure better prices for their fish, hoping that then incentivizes them to engage in responsible practices because their livelihood is increasing and improving.
May I jump in for a more maybe EU developed country perspective? Because we have been releasing a report on the socioeconomic impact of the fisheries policy in the EU. And we discover that for small-scale fishers, often they pay almost under minimum wage. They're not really necessarily work full-time, but often they pay much more less than, you know, the large-scale industries. And I think this is linked to a question of fairness. It was also in our report, because fish are common goods, you know, common resources. So when you have quota, how you share it between different gear, fleets, and everything. And in the EU, it's not really transparent. So we don't know in each member state how they share quota. If it's based on, is your gear selective? Do you contribute socio-economically to, you know, the economy of the coastal communities and stuff like that? So it's really something that we're pushing for the EU to be more transparent in how they share quota as a question of fairness.
Mm-hmm. I think from a profitability perspective for small-scale fishers and linking to certification, which I mentioned earlier. So if you think about something like the MSC, which is arguably the most well-recognised seafood certification brand, let's call it, the number of small-scale fishers that are currently certified and are able to be certified is very low. And often it's impacted, again, by company sourcing policies. So you have a lot of retailers that are now committing to source only from MSC-certified stocks. But the fact that small-scale fishers are unable to achieve certification, not because they're not fishing sustainably, but because they're not able to afford high audit costs and assessment costs. So there's a real clear barrier to small-scale fishers engaging in certification. So I think there's a piece there that needs to be done in terms of making certification schemes more accessible and ensuring that the barriers to small-scale fishers engaging in those are removed or reduced as much as possible.
Yeah. And Antonia, I mean, as well as we had the example of Thailand with the legislation, MSC certification, what other methods and practices or legislation have you seen that gives you hope that solutions are being found?
Yes, recently, actually, we saw a lot of development in terms of co-management And he came from the field, from the fisher. Then he became a national law. We saw that in Portugal, in Croatia. And so they developed kind of a circular economy, which allows them, you know, to have profit, to have, short trade kind of impact. It was really profitable for the fisher, but also for the biodiversity around them, because they were also setting up themselves to protect areas, you know, marine areas, which were also benefiting them as a spillover effect, you know.
And I'm interested in the sort of the... You know, it might sound a bit heartless to say it, but the potential upside of helping out with sustainability. I mean, surely this is an opportunity for, you know, this is a food industry podcast. We have lots of investors listening to this as well. You know, technology must be useful at some level here. Sophie, have you seen technology that might be a game changer for the industry?
There's all sorts of progress being made on tech to make fishing gear more sustainable. For example, the TEDs, the turtle exclusion devices that Antonia mentioned. There was also a very cool piece of research recently about scallop discos. I don't know if you saw that.
Yes, I did read this. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So as opposed to dredging, which is obviously incredibly destructive, if you use a light attracting a light for attracting the scallops, literally just dance and jump into the creel pots. There's also, different ways of making particular bottom contacting gears less bottom contacting, but I think that's a little bit of a work in progress. I think the other piece where tech really comes into its own is in the enforcement side. So if you're looking at marine protected areas that have been established for a particular key biodiversity feature or element of marine biodiversity, often in a nearshore zone, which is important to the small scale fishers. If you can engage often with satellite tech and AI and things like that to support the Coast Guard or whatever the government body is that has responsibility for patrolling the waters, to reduce the effort that they need to put in by using satellite tech or other imagery-based systems, then there's a real potential there for kind of significant change and the ability of countries to be able to enforce and patrol their own waters much more efficiently.
Yeah. So I'm interested in how much of this is all about politics as well. Here in the UK, fishing is only about 0.5% of GDP. The political clout of the industry is small. And yet there is a nationalistic sort of drive to this. You know, that certainly when Brexit happened, all the Brexiteers were banging on about British fish, using it as a flag to wave, saying that this is our stuff. Now, it's not really, is it? It's the common, as you both said, I think it's the common good. It belongs to everybody. Antonia, is the fate of fish stocks really down to politics, do you think?
Yes, and I think the fishery sector can be a bit small. In the EU, it represents 1% of the GDP, maybe. But there is a lot of indirect economic impact, like for coastal community, for tourism, and we don't take really that into account. And the sector is really well structured, and it allows them to speak to politicians, you know, and to really have influence on them. Maybe it's a bit harder for the small-scale fisher, you know, to come to Brussels, but we work with them, with the civil society, to try to raise their voice as well. So yes, and politicians should really look at it, because as you say, it's a common good, you know, it's owned by everyone or by no one. So yeah, I think it's political, because we also pay taxes, and so to subsidize sustainable activities, for instance. But we don't know where these subsidies are going, and we know today that some subsidies are really harmful. And so we kind of contributing to harmful activity with our taxes sometimes. So yeah, it's political. I mean, the fish is owned by everyone.
Okay, and just last question for both of you, really. Reasons for optimism, Sophie? Do you come into work every day fighting an uphill battle, or do you, are there successes that you can point out to us?
Yeah, I don't think I could come to work every day if the situation was entirely dire. So there's definite potential out there. I think consumer demand and market pressure is slowly pushing the industry to be more transparent and to employ more responsible sourcing practices
do you think that's enough? So seeing certification on the label of a bit of fish, do you think that's enough for people to make a significant change?
For the consumer, possibly. For the global good, no. I think policy needs to be used to support the changes that are needed. I mean, I think it does fundamentally all come down to money and politics, as Antonia has mentioned. But ultimately, if the fishing industry wants to remain profitable, it needs to change. Because on the current trajectory, you know, there will be no fishing industry as we know it in an undetermined number of years. We are on a trajectory of decline. So if the industry wants to remain in some form, and if we are going to be able to continue to feed the world, then we need to be pushing and supporting governments to implement policies that will make those changes.
Yeah. Okay. So, Antonia, last question for you. Same thing again, really. You know, we've heard from both of you that the fishing industry is cannibalizing itself by creating problems that it's not going to be able to solve at the rate it's going. Are there reasons for optimism, though? Is there something that you can point to which is good practice and that you'd like to see more of?
Yes, I mean, I have hope. I see a really good initiative, and I see also the future generation being more and more aware about climate change and environmental issues. So they're really much willing to be sometimes transparent as well, use technologies, as we mentioned before, to also have more knowledge about our marine ecosystem, which you don't have a lot currently. So knowledge are improving, which I'm hopeful, which will help to also have better fisheries management. And I don't think the fishers, you know, are against having sustainable stock because they want also, I mean, they have economic interest, but they want also to be able to fish in the long term. And I think what I see coming is also more and more the question of level playing field. So they understand, at least in the EU, that they cannot compete, you know, in an unfair competition worldwide. So they need to be sustainable. And we need also to have good policies in terms of imports and everything. So we set up the bar a bit higher. And I see consumer and retailer also asking for better product, more transparency. And I think this is a way forward. There is still some work to do, especially with policymakers. I mean, currently we are revising the fisheries control regulation in the EU, and we're not done yet. We really ask for traceability, but there is improvement and hopefully fast enough.
Okay. All right, fantastic. Antonia Leroy and Sophie Bembo, thank you so much, both of you, for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. And remember, if you enjoy the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe on your preferred platform so you never miss an episode. And please give us a review. Lovely to speak to you, and thank you very much for listening.